Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue to help you learn, we hope that you can include these things that we're learning and things that we need to start seeing, need to start doing, and that's something you can include in your appeal to heaven. Learn, pray, and act. So, in addition, or on top of all of this, it is all about pursuing the compliance to the Constitution. Now, we're in the Virginia ratification debates, and we're out of 400-some pages, we're about 135 pages into it. And you think, well, we're over one-fourth the way. Not even close, folks. Because the really long debates and a lot of really good information is still to come. And there is no doubt, as they discussed the application of martial law for the federal government, and they talked about the application of the deployment of the militia, what they can do, and so forth. It is all right here of how those things were delineated. And, well, why is it important that it was at least delineated in one state over another? In other words, does it need to be, did these assertions that occurred in Virginia or assertions that occurred in Massachusetts, were they not applicable to all states and the federal government? Or did they need to be duplicated so that it was, you know, equally stipulated? No, it only needed to be stipulated once. And once it's been applied, once the stipulation has been basically asserted, then it is applicable to all states because the federal government cannot treat states differently. Case in point. And Massachusetts, was it two or three times, I think we brought up, maybe even four, that we brought up that the Congress cannot pass a law and immune themselves from it. No other state in the Union made that stipulation or assertion. So does that mean that only the Massachusetts Congress people and senators cannot pass a law? In other words, they can't immune themselves, but the rest of them can? No. Congress has to treat every state and they have to act equally or uniformly. The requirement of uniformity is a part of the federal government and I'll just say the powers given. If they're going to exert powers, they need to exert them uniformly, such as the militia, martial law. Oh, well, because it was in Virginia that they said they can't declare martial law unless the militia has been deployed there, well, then that only happens in Virginia. No, it happens in every state. So what really should have happened, and Madison was seeing this, and he was trying to emphasize this, but at that point in time, the maturity of contract law wasn't there. I mean, what would have happened today if this was a contract that the multiple parties created with the federal government? Then the federal government would sit down and they would go through all the stipulations that they made, because this particular case, they would be making the stipulations. And throughout the different discourses or the ratification processes, as they're out there advocating and stipulating, what they would then do is they would compile a complete list, a bibliography of every stipulation, so that it will be applied equally throughout through the execution of the contract. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's what should have happened. But they didn't have that maturity and discipline regarding contract law. And because of that, they allowed themselves to ingratiate the lawyers or to make the lawyers feel really important by concocting terms of new laws that don't exist, such as constitutional law. The Constitution is a contract. It is a compact. There's no way that a compact becomes its own discipline of law. Does that make sense? It's kind of like, let's say you have AT&T cell phone service. You've got an AT&T contract. Now, how that is to be executed and so forth, you know, are they going to create an AT&T law like the constitutional law? Because the law would be basically focused on the execution and operation of that contract, how things were stipulated, how things were agreed upon. Really? No, it's contract law. The Constitution is a subpart of contract law. That's it. There's no such thing as constitutional law. But to create that sound, to create that phrase, that term, oh boy, isn't that awesome? Man, I studied constitutional law. Well, that doesn't get me anywhere, because if that's the case, then you don't know anything about contract law. And that's where the problem lies, folks, because they think that they've got this own unique discipline when it's not. It falls under contract law, which is one of the reasons why Madison harangued the state legislature as they were asking for explanations. He went back and just bow, pow, pow. These are the fundamentals of contract law. These are based on the principles and the nature of a compact. Or actually, the nature of a constitution, which basically it is a compact. Anyway, so now we're diving down into interposition, where now John Marshall talks a little bit. Now, interposition can be used in lots of ways. When we talk about interposition, we talk about interposition specifically with the states or the counties interposing upon the government that they've created. I.e. the counties would be interposing upon the state legislature. The state legislatures would be imposing upon the federal government. So actually not the state legislature, the state government, because the counties created it all. They created the government and that constitution. And so it's the same thing with the states. The states created the government and the constitution. So they would be interposing on any and everything under that umbrella. So anyway, now he's diving into interposition. And are you ready? Are you there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yep.
Let's go ahead.
The honorable gentleman has asked if there be any safety or freedom when we give away the sword and the purse. Shall the people at large hold the sword and the purse without the interposition of their representatives? Can the whole aggregate community act personally? I apprehend that every gentleman will see the impossibility of this. Must they then not trust them to others? To whom are they to trust them but to their representatives, who are accountable for their conduct? He represents secrecy as unnecessary and produces the British government as a proof of its inutility. Is there no secrecy there? When deliberating on the propriety of declaring war or on military arrangements, do they deliberate in the open fields? No, sir. The British government affords secrecy when necessary, and so ought every government. In this plan, secrecy is only used when it would be fatal and pernicious to publish the schemes of government.
Okay, so that makes sense. All right, so moving down to, let me see here, George Nicholas. Now, this is a good one, because this is where George Nicholas dives into preferential treatment, right? And so we actually see in Article 1, Section 9, that the federal government cannot treat any port or any state preferentially. In other words, give them a better favor. If they're going to, you know, have contracts, if they're going to be receiving shipments, you know, or sending shipments out, you know, for aid or what have you, let's say they have the constitutional authority to send things out, because technically they don't today. But if they did have that, then they would have to probably not ship everything out of one port. They would probably be, you know, needing to ship it out over those few ports. That would be logical. I mean, if it's going to the, you know, to the, I'll say the Orient or somewhere in Asia, then the Western ports, San Diego up to Seattle, that would be reasonable. Shipping it out of the Eastern seaboard would be absolutely unreasonable, because the fares, the cost would be just, you know, stupid. It just doesn't make sense to send it out that way. But they cannot pick a particular port. They cannot pick a particular state to have an advantage. And so the concept was to make sure that the federal government was never putting its finger or thumb on the scale of economic, you know, liberties or economic benefits. Those, because if they did that, then the other states that didn't have those favors would be at a bigger disadvantage. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is what Mr. Nicholas says about preferential treatment.
There are many strong reasons to expect that the adoption of this system will be beneficial to the backcountry, and that their interests will be much better attended to under the new than under the old government. There are checks in this Constitution which will render the navigation of the Mississippi safer than it was under the Confederation. There is a clause which, in my opinion, will prohibit the general government from relinquishing that navigation. The fifth clause of the ninth section of the first article provides that no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another.
Okay.
If Congress be expressly prohibited to give preference to the ports of one state over those of another, there is a strong implication that they cannot give preference to the ports of any foreign nation over those of a state.
Okay.
This will render it unconstitutional to give Spain a preference to the western country in the navigation of that river. They may say that this is a constrained construction, but it appears to me rational. It would be a violation of true policy to give such a preference. It would be a departure from natural construction to suppose that an advantage withheld from the state should be given to a foreign nation.
Right. And so the only reason that a foreign nation would receive an advantage or a temporary advantage would be as a condition of a treaty like the Louisiana Territory, the Louisiana Purchase. And in so doing, in that treaty, they basically provided a limited time for the nation of France and Spain to be able to ship goods in, because at that point in time, they were capable and free to ship goods in without any imposts, without any taxes. So they were given a short period of time where they could actually continue to ship into that port without being hit with imposts. So it's not a preference. It was a condition predicated upon the transfer, and it was in our strategic interest to do that. And so giving those two nations this, you know, the stipulated advantage was directly because they were giving us a steal of a deal on this land and this port that became a huge strategic win. So, okay. So now we're going to dive into common law. And there's a lot of other sub points underneath this. This is all George Nicholas. This guy, for not going to the Constitutional Convention, he had a great and a profound understanding of the Constitution. It was absolutely just mind-boggling how well he understood this and how well he articulated the Constitution. Go ahead.
Under the Confederation, Congress cannot make a treaty without the consent of 9 states. Congress, by the proposed plan, cannot make a treaty without the consent of 2/3 of the senators present and of the president. 2/3 will amount to 9 states if the senators from all the states be present. Can it be candidly and fairly supposed that they will not all or nearly all be present when so important a subject as a treaty is to be agitated? The consent of the president is a very great security. He's elected by the people at large. He will not have the local interest which the members of Congress may have. If he deviates from his duty, he is responsible to his constituents. He will be degraded and will bring on his head the accusation of the representatives of the people, an accusation which has ever been and always will be very formidable. He will be absolutely disqualified to hold any place of profit, honor, or trust, and liable to further punishment if he has committed such high crimes as are punishable at common law.
Okay. All right. So now we go down a little bit further, because they're talking about crimes at common law. Now, so what are crimes at common law? Okay, so, and actually, when we left yesterday, we were talking about common law and the legal system, and how I think it was Marshall that was basically pointing out that we had this, you know, the trial by jury, those types of things were going to be preserved. Well, the Constitution didn't protect that. The Constitution gave the judiciary, instead of declaring common law, it gave the judiciary the ability to interface with the legal system of the state. This is something that I think really became an epiphany to me, and it started connecting more and more when I realized that common law is not what these experts are telling you, folks. Common law is a legal system that is deployed or employed in a government to ensure justice under the supreme law of the land. So when we look at common law under the U.S. Constitution, the justice is those things that we are protected, or those things that the government is expected to do. If they do something that's not, then we have a right of common law over those things. Does that make sense? In other words, if they started importing people into the states, then those people could be exported, or I should say deported, because they didn't have the authority to do that. And we could seek justice in common law to do that, because as our state would say, hey, you know, you don't have that. The federal government didn't have the jurisdiction over a lot of different crimes. So it's incumbent upon the federal government to deal with those things at the state level if it is arising under the Constitution. So in this particular case, on immigration, because the federal government didn't have the authority, they brought these folks in, then the state would basically push back and go, you don't have this authority. You need to deport them. You need to get them out of the United States. You did not have, you have no authority in that Constitution for the importation of people. We don't care if you've got a treaty that you signed off on. That power for you to sign off on that treaty to import people has to be a part of your enumerated powers. Now, we're going to get into this with Mr. Nicholas as well, because he clearly defines this, that they cannot create a treaty that is not within their enumerated powers. So if they don't have the power in the Constitution for the importation of people, then they can't sign on a treaty to give them that power with a foreign nation so that they can do it to us. Does that make sense? Because that would be, that literally is backdooring the authority that the sovereigns have given this general government to do. This subcontractor, this child government that they created to serve them, it would be their way of backdooring all of the power that the parents have. And they don't have that ability. That was clearly stipulated by George Nicholas. Again, a very profound expert, you know, I'll just say a politician and a statesman of the time, really had a profound understanding of the Constitution. So anyway, as we look, let me just dive into this common law and this legal system. As it stands, the legal system is designed to support the supreme law of the land. Well, with the supreme law of the land being the Constitution and it being very finite and detailed, then common law is very limited into what the federal government can be involved in. Can they be involved in marriage? No. If it's not enumerated in the Constitution, then it cannot be in their court. So where is marriage going to be if there's a dissolvement of a marriage, or there's going to be a union created? Where is that delegated in the legal system? So it's not at the federal level. So common law, if you look at common law and the commentaries of common law that Blackstone created, that was all a part of the British monarchical theocracy, which was all encompassed in the British king, or I should say the British monarch. And so in America, the common law for the federal government is very, very limited and defined. Very limited to find. Now, when you get to the state, the question is now, because we're just using this one example, marriage. Is marriage delegated to your state government to be able to grant, dissolve, and regulate? If it's not, then they don't have the authority in that constitution or period to be involved in common law courts over marriage. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so unless we, the people, have delegated it, then they can't administer it at their level. So where is the common law going to be held when it comes to marriage? It has to be down at the local level. Unfortunately, we never really, or unfortunately, actually, I think it's a two-sided head. It's both good news and bad news, because we never created a county constitution. We never basically delegated that power over marriage. And so the lawyers, they said, hey, we got to capture the money on this because there's money to be made. We're going to assume the power without actually giving the, without the people giving them that power. See how the courts have constantly assumed jurisdiction over everything.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me we have a Republican form of government when the courts are running around sucking up everything. It's almost like they're the ones that rule us. Folks, it's time to wake up. And when we look at common law, we're going to have to really break down what is common law in your state. Well, it's got to be based, one, at the state level of what the state can be involved in based on those enumerated powers and objects. If it is not at the county level, then the people actually will possess the power of the common law. In other words, how were divorces and marriages performed in common law? Back in the old days, it was done by the church. And in other words, whoever basically foreordained that marriage, it would be up to them to actually to break asunder. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. That's how we are to live. And I understand that it's complicated, but I'm telling you, folks, it is a far better system to have that layer of protections and checks and balances than it is to give the federal government full control over every aspect of our lives. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact is, the commentaries on common law need to be written for each state in mind. We need an expert in every state to sit down and start writing the commentaries on common law by looking at your state constitution. And oh, by the way, if we have our way, there's going to be many states, if not all of the states' constitutions, are going to be redone to where the state is going to have even less power. So most of the power and most of the commentaries for common law will have to be done down at the county level. If the people want the church to be involved in administering and allowing marriage, then that's it. The government can't step in and say, we will have civil marriages. No, we never delegated you that authority. You can't do it. You see the point?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is where we actually start really controlling both our legal system as well as our government. And this was something that was foreordained based on this exemplar constitution. It was supposed to peel all of these things, but people started making up their own, I'll just say, their own assumptions. They started assuming things, and they started literally taking on things like the courts started taking on jurisdiction over everything when they don't have that authority. And so when we actually start pushing this forward, this is the beauty of what we have delegated. The few things we've delegated are those only those things that they should be doing. So it makes it easy to start getting rid of stuff that they shouldn't be doing and can't do. Anyway, I'm sorry it took this long, but we're pretty much out of time for this segment. So when we come back, I know we just covered common law. So when we come back, folks, we're going to dive into George Nicholas's a short oration on direct taxes and the stipulations that he creates for that. Then he'll go into the general defense of welfare. Then he goes into just general taxes. Then he goes into the necessary and proper clause. And then he kind of wraps it up for a want of the Bill of Rights. So anyway, as we kind of go into break here, we'll be right back with a short promo, or after the short promo. So please stay tuned. And hopefully this helps you understand common law is a beautiful thing, but we just don't have it because the courts have completely taken over our complete legal system and redefined it. We'll be back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we're going to dive into this direct taxes because we've kind of covered common law to ad nauseum, right? I mean, I think I've maybe bored everybody to this point. So let's go ahead and then look at these direct taxes and why they're so important. Go ahead.
Okay. Another argument made use of is that ours is the largest state and must pay in proportion to the other states. How does that appear? The proportion of taxes are fixed by the number of inhabitants and not regulated by the extent of territory or fertility of soil. If we be wealthier in proportion than other states, it will fall lighter upon us than upon poorer states. They must fix the taxes so that the poorer state can pay, and Virginia, being richer, will bear it easier. The honorable gentleman says that the first collections are to go to Congress, and that the state legislatures must bear all deficiencies. How does this appear? Does he prove it? Nothing of it appears in the plan itself. The Congress and the state legislatures have concurrent jurisdictions in laying and collecting taxes. There is no rule that shows that Congress shall have the first collections. Each is independent of the other. Another argument against this disingenuous construction is drawn from that clause which regulates representation, which is conclusive from the words themselves. Quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the representative numbers, close quote. Each state will know from its population its proportion of any general tax. As it will justly observe by the gentleman over the way, Mr. Randolph, they cannot possibly exceed that proportion. They are limited and restrained expressly to it. The state legislatures have no check of this kind. Their power is uncontrolled. This excludes the danger of interference. Each collects its own taxes and bears its own deficiencies, and officers are accountable to each government for the different collections.
Okay, so that's kind of interesting where he talks about that the states, you know, are wide open. Well, over time, many of the states, when they started creating state governments, many states actually started constraining the type of taxes that the state could collect. So in the state of Wyoming and the state of Washington, the legislature cannot tax income. The legislature can tax property. Now, when we look at, because you and I covered the Constitutional Convention, the concept was that they were basically going to tax property, because that's what the South wanted. Because if they taxed property, then the other states would actually pay more, because it had to be equal, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because the Southern states were very well developed, and their property was worth a lot. So the other states would then have to be based on how many people or what have you, and how many parcels of property they were going to basically go after. It would have been an unfair system. And so what they did was they wanted to make sure that they tried to create a system that would be as equally fair and, you know, uniform in the taxation as he points out here, that the richer a state is, the less they pay in taxes, because it is apportioned by people, not by their holdings, not by their property, right? So, in other words, as the apportionment goes out per person, it's so much ahead. It still creates, the poorer states will always be at a disadvantage, but they have to bear their equal share. The concept, you know, as we look at the divine order here, it's kind of like tithing. It's a set percent where and as a matter of fact, it required uniformity. Regardless of what the percentage was, it had to be uniform across the states. So what that means is the concept of the 16th Amendment of being, you know, scaling taxation. So the more you make, the more you have to pay. That right there basically violates the uniformity standard. It shouldn't matter how much you make. All people should be, you know, charged to, you know, pay their the same percentage.
Right.
And so even though 10% of a small number is a very small number, but 10% of a large number is a very large number, right? I mean, 10% of $100 is $10. 10% of $1 billion is $100 million, right? Right. So, I mean, that's a lot of money. Oh, well, that 900, don't even talk to me about that. It's the same. This is why when we look at the penal system and the fines and fees that they assess, you know, how they just make it a flat rate, that is not equitable. That is not uniform. It gives people with more money affluence a bigger advantage because they're paying what a poor person would have to pay when they should actually pay their fair share. It should be a flat percentage. It should be 10% of your income. It should be half of your income. Drunk driving, 100% of your annual income. Now, if you don't have income, like, you know, Warren Buffett, then it should be 10% of your holdings. And what that's because, see, what billionaires have done is they've hidden behind, you know, these, they don't take income, they just have holdings. And they, you know, they live off their investments or what have you. So it seems like they don't bring in any income, so they don't pay any taxes. Well, the best way to deal with that is to basically say 10% of your holdings then. And we'll just keep taking 10% away from your holdings. You violate the law, boom, that's what it is. Or whatever your taxes are. I mean, the whole point of taxation is to have a fair, equitable system so that everybody equally contributes. Doesn't matter. You know, and as a matter of fact, there used to be a point in time of pride and honor where, you know, nobody, you know, wanted, you know, as nice as it is not have to reach into your pocket, to basically, you know, say, you know, oh, well, you don't have to because, you know, because of your color, your race, your culture, your gender, what have you, because your lack of money. No, no, no. I'm going to pay my fair share. That's the right and honorable thing to do. Whatever happened to that in our society? Well, you know, give me an advantage. This is how we constantly destroy ourselves. But anyway, let's go down to the General Defense and Welfare Clause.
It provides, quote, that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, close quote. The debts of the Union ought to be paid. Ought not the common defense to be provided for? Is it not necessary to provide for the general welfare? It has been fully proved that this power could not be given to another body. The amounts to be raised are confined to these purposes solely. Will oppressive burdens be warranted by this clause? They are not to raise money for any other purpose. It is a power which is drawn from his favorite confederation, the 8th article of which provides that all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value value of all lands within each state granted to or surveyed for any person as such land and the building and improvements thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint.
And I think that there's a close quote right there. But anyway.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
So now he goes into the taxes. Because bottom line, there's a lot more language in the Articles of Confederation regarding this preamble of the point of powers. But the way they did this was they basically created this preamble that we're going to have the federal government, we're granting them the ability to tax us, these types of taxes. And they're going to do this for the general defense and welfare. In other words, not to give us welfare, but for the overall welfare of the Union. Not a particular state, not because you had a hurricane or an earthquake or what have you. No welfare that way. Welfare is just general intent that everybody will be provided for generally in the auspices of the defense and the powers granted. If it is not actually specified as a power of granting and ensuring, you know, a living wage or, you know, food on your table, then the government cannot be involved in providing those types of products. So anyway, let's go into the part below this. The taxes for paying that proportion.
Oh. The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled. Quote, now, sir, by a comparison of this article with the claims of the Constitution, we shall find them to be nearly the same. The common defense and general welfare are the objects expressly mentioned to be provided for in both systems. The power in the Confederation to secure and provide for those objects was constitutionally unlimited. The requisitions of Congress are binding on the states, though from the imbecility of their nature they cannot be enforced. The same power is intended by the Constitution. The only difference between them is that Congress is by this plan to impose the taxes on the people, whereas by the Confederation they are laid by the states. The amount to be raised and the powers and the power given to raise it is the same in principle. The mode of raising only is different, and this difference is founded on the necessity of giving the government that energy without which it cannot exist. The power has not been reprobated in the Confederation. It ought not to be blamed in the proposed plan of government. I'm assuming there's a close quote there.
Yeah, that's fine. And so, necessary. Now he goes into the sweeping clause. Go ahead.
Okay. The gentleman has adverted to what he calls the sweeping clause, etc., and represents it as replete with great dangers. This dreaded clause runs in the following words, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof, close quote. The committee will perceive that the Constitution had enumerated all the powers which the general government should have, but did not say how they were to be exercised. It therefore, in this clause, tells how they shall be exercised. Does this give any new power? I say not. Suppose it had been inserted at the end of every power that they should have power to make laws to carry that power to execution. Would this have increased their powers? If therefore it could not have increased their powers if placed at the end of each power, it cannot increase them at the end of all. This clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but gives them no additional powers. No additional power.
That really makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To make laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into the execution the foregoing powers and all other powers mm-hmm. vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in the department or officer thereof. Okay, you have these powers, so now you can make the laws that are necessary and proper for the execution of them. All she said is, hey, we could actually, you know, the power to declare war and make all laws necessary and proper to do this. And the power to call forth the militia to execute blah, 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 and all the powers necessary and proper to do this. So he said, instead of putting it at the end of each listed power, they just put it at the end and clearly tied it to the foregoing powers. The foregoing powers.
They should have put
powers.
It at every single end.
You know, well, so that's, to me, that's just placating idiots.
Yeah, I agree, but it seems like we needed a, I don't know, for dummies.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I understand, but you get to a point where you say, come on, you're being completely unreasonable for you to be making those assumptions, because the clarity is right there. The foregoing powers. Not any power you want, mm-hmm. just the four. You can only do the necessary and proper law. You can create laws that are necessary and proper for the execution of the foregoing powers. Not for some power you just concocted.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, now this next one is really for a want of a Bill of Rights. So let's go ahead and go into this.
Okay. But it is objected to for want of a Bill of Rights. It is a principle universally agreed upon that all powers not given are retained, whereby the Constitution, the general government, has general powers for any purpose. Its powers are absolute. Whereas powers with some exceptions, they are absolute only as to those exceptions. In either case, the people retain what is not conferred on the general government, as it is by their positive grant that it has any of its powers. In England, in all disputes between the king and people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, etc.? If not, they are, generally speaking, within the king's prerogative. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it.
Pretty simple, right? I mean, straightforward? Mm-hmm. Duh. Okay. All right. So the key is the reverse proposition holds. When he says the recurrence, so in other words, if the king creates a law and somebody says, hey, you know, I think that's violating my rights. So they have to go and look, is this right actually enumerated in the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, etc.? If it's not, then it truly is the king's prerogative. So this goes into the stupidity of thinking you're so brilliant that you're going to come up with every right that you'll want secured from government for all time and eternity. But you didn't think about computers and, you know, cybersecurity and cyber, you know, protections, those types of things. Or, you know, the camera state where, you know, taking cameras and video and so forth. Well, you didn't say we couldn't monitor you. You didn't say that you had a right not to have your facial recognition stuff, you know, in our database so that we can monitor you. That's not stipulated in the Bill of Rights. Well, actually, it is by being secure in our persons. But more importantly, anything that is not stipulated. Remember, the Ninth Amendment is the catch-all. The Ninth Amendment basically says, any enumeration within the Constitution, you know, of a right cannot be. Let me dive into it because I want to get it right. And so the only way to get it right is to actually read it. So the Ninth Amendment says this: the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, if you have a right to the freedom of speech, that you can use that right. But you can't use that right to disparage or deny other people rights that they've had retained. And it's the same thing with government having the enumerations. If the government has an enumeration over marriage, we actually made the mistake of giving them the ability to be involved in marriage. It doesn't mean that they, because the right of parental rights over their children, unless that's enumerated, then that right there, the right of marriage, does not get them into the family and regulating the entire family. It only means the marriage of, you know, man and woman or whatever. Bottom line, they cannot basically construe to deny or disparage the rights of the parents over their children, those types of things. So the Ninth Amendment is a huge catch-all that actually protects us from those things that we may not have thought of. But they did a very good job so far with the Bill of Rights, as far as I'm concerned. All right, so now as we look and move on to Wednesday, Mr. Madison steps up, and now he talks a little bit more about the militia of some things we, or at least I, missed before, and I think that this is important. So let's go ahead and go through this.
Okay. First, then, is it necessary? I must acknowledge that I concur in opinion with those gentlemen who told you that this branch of revenue was essential to the salvation of the Union. It appears to me necessary in order to secure that punctuality which is necessary in revenue matters. Without punctuality, individuals will give it no confidence, without which it cannot get resources. I beg, gentlemen, to consider the situation of this country. If unhappily the government were to be deprived of this power, let us suppose for a moment that one of those powers which may be unfriendly to us should take advantage of our weakness, which they will be more ready to do when they know the want of this resource in our government. Suppose it should attack us. What forces could we oppose to it? Could we find safety in such forces as we could call out? Could we call forth a sufficient number, either by draughts or any other way, to repel a powerful enemy? The inability of the government to raise and support regular troops would compel us to depend on militia.
Okay, so what he just said is the drought, in other words, a draft, to basically, you know, say, okay, you know, here's the birthdays, however they wanted to do the draft. But technically, the federal government can't do the draft because the states do the militia. And so what the federal government is to do is to basically call forth the militia by basically saying, you know, we need 10% out of every state, or we need this, you know, and so for it to be equitable, right? So a smaller state should not have to deploy more militiamen, you know, in percentage than a larger state. So the only thing that matters is that the federal government basically says, we need this many people coming out of each of the states, this percentage of your militia to come, because that will give us the end number that we need. You know, and they look, we need, you know, 200,000 people. And they go, okay, we've got 20 states, but we can't take 10 out of each because the populations are different. So what they do is they look at the overall population of America, it being 50 million, and they say, okay, we need this many people as a percentile out of each of the states, which would then derive that, you know, 50,000 people. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't know if my numbers, I kept my numbers squared, but bottom line is the draft and how the state administers and maintains their militia is their responsibility. The federal government only needs to put out a requisition of how many people there to send in. There is no way. This is why he even says this. The inability of the government to raise and support regular troops would compel us to depend on the militia, because they don't have that ability.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that means that everybody is now dependent on the states in this national system. All right. So Madison then goes into these other things that he wants to kind of talk about. And so let's go ahead. I have a general note here, but let me see if I can make this less ambiguous. Go ahead.
Okay. I shall take a view of certain subjects, which will lead to some reflections to quiet the minds of those gentlemen who think that the individual governments will be swallowed up by the general government. In order to effect this, it is proper to compare the state governments with the general government with respect to reciprocal dependence and with respect to the means they have of supporting themselves or of encroaching on one another. At the first comparison, we must be struck with these remarkable facts. The general government has not the appointment of a single branch of the individual governments, or of any officers within the states, to execute their laws. Are not the states integral parts of the general government? Is not the president chosen under the influence of these state legislatures? May we not suppose that he will be complicit to those from whom he has his appointment and from whom he must have his reappointment? The senators are appointed altogether by the legislatures. My honorable friend apprehended a coalition between the President, Senate, and House of Representatives against the states. This could be supposed only from a similarity of the component parts. A coalition is not likely to take place because its component parts are heterogeneous in their nature. The House of Representatives is not chosen by the state governments, but under the influence of those who compose the state legislatures. Let us suppose 10 men appointed to carry the government into effect. There is every degree of certainty that they would be indebted for their re-election to the members of the legislatures. If they derive their appointment from them, will they not execute their duty to them? Besides this, will not the people, whose predominant interests will ultimately prevail, feel great attachment to the state legislatures? They have the care of all local interests, those familiar domestic objects for which men have the strongest predilection. The general government, on the contrary, has the preservation of the aggregate interests of the Union. Objects which, being less familiar and more remote from men's notice, have a less powerful influence on their minds. Do we not see great and natural attachments arising from local considerations? This will be the case in as much stronger degree in state governments than in the general government. The people will be attached to their state legislatures from 1,000 causes, and into whatever scale the people at large will throw themselves, that scale will preponderate.
Okay, so actually I realize we've got basically a minute left. So this kind of wraps up what we can cover for today. And you should have heard me yelling at you because you couldn't, because I was mute. Anyway, so we're going to dive into, because we're going to kind of skip down to Mr. Grayson. Now, Mr. Grayson is an anti-federalist, but he's kind of an anti-federalist that is more asking questions, and he keeps asking a lot of the same questions over and over again. He sometimes stumbles into the right position, but in this particular case, he wants to point out the fact that there are two sovereigns, and there are two sovereigns, you know, i.e. the state and federal government, and then there are two sovereigns within the legislature. And so when we come back on Tuesday next week, we'll be able to dive into this right here with Mr. Grayson. And this is on June 11th. And folks, we're getting really close to going through the deep details regarding the militia, martial law, and so forth. So thank you, Tammy, for joining us. And with that, I'm hoping, folks, that as we go through this, you can hear how they clearly delineated and consistently delineated that the powers are definite and limited to those objects enumerated. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.